Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Melinda St. Louis of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who examines the strong public opposition to free trade deals as expressed by voters in both Democratic and Republican Party primary campaigns. Robert Poland, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, who talks about his study, which found that the green economy produces three times as many jobs as the fossil fuel energy industry. And Tim Judson of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, who assesses the status of the ongoing Fukushima nuclear disaster and cleanup on the fifth anniversary of the worst nuclear accident since Chernobyl. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The women of El Salvador face a growing risk of violence in the home. In the first 9 months of 2015, the nation's attorney general reported 1,200 cases of familial violence committed against women, totaling about 5 cases a day. At the same time, the National Civilian Police reported 5 incidents of sexual violence daily, including rape and incest. Women who try to protect teen males suspected of being gang members are often targeted by police. Vanda Pignato, El Salvador's Secretary of Social Inclusion, says that many women remain silent about violence out of fear, shame, and terror, and the judicial system in El Salvador leaves much to be desired. Despite progress in enacting laws against those committing violence targeting women and appointing prosecutors focused on gender-based violence, basic services like emergency shelters for female victims remain scarce. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights chastised El Salvador's courts for being ineffective, inaccessible, and discriminatory on familial and domestic violence issues. The pressure on low-income adults across the U.S. is more intense in 2016, due in large part to the sharp limits on public assistance, first imposed by welfare reform legislation signed into law in the 1990s. The value of cash aid to poor families has fallen sharply over the last 20 years. In July, Arizona will be the first state in the U.S. to limit cash assistance to 12 months during an individual's lifetime. In 1996, President Bill Clinton made a deal with Republican Speaker Newt Gingrich to support the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Act, which ties government cash assistance to employment. The reform law allowed states to impose harsh limits on assistance through the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program known as TANF. 20 years ago, Arizona set up a series of programs to assist single parents to find jobs, provide childcare, and enhance workforce skills. But according to the Guardian newspaper, these programs were slashed after the economy melted down in 2008. As unemployment in the state hit 11%, the conservative state legislature gutted TANF amid complaints about increased dependency and rising costs. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, the number of TANF recipients fell in 16 states, even as unemployment and economic hardship increased. And the value of individual benefits has also fallen sharply. Congress has not increased the funding for TANF in 20 years, which with inflation equals a fall in real benefit dollars by more than one-third. After the Flint, Michigan water crisis emerged as a national issue, Democrats in New Jersey's legislature revised a bill to provide aid to homeowners to remove lead paint and relocate families when children tested positive for high levels of lead in their blood. In January, New Jersey's Republican governor and former presidential candidate Chris Christie refused to sign the $10 million supplemental bill to fund the lead paint removal program. The fund, established in 2004, has not been refunded in 6 years, as governors diverted revenues to pay for state operations. In a press conference in early March, Christie said the issue had been overdramatized and blamed Democrats for requesting extra funding and driving the state's budget problems. According to New Jersey Spotlight, 225,000 children in New Jersey were exposed to lead paint poisoning since 2000. Advocates for the poor in the Garden State say children in 11 New Jersey cities have higher rates of lead in their blood than children living in Flint, Michigan, where state government made cost-cutting decisions that led to the contamination of the city's drinking water supply. Elise Pivnik, director of environmental health for Isles, Inc., observed, because of Flint, most of the world knows lead in the water can poison children. But it's just as tragic and alarming that thousands of children in New Jersey continued to be exposed to lead year after year. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders' upset win in Michigan's March 8th primary defied polls that predicted that he would lose to Hillary Clinton by 18 to 20 points. 538.com polling expert Nate Silver said Sanders' surprise win was among the greatest polling errors in primary history. With the steep loss of good-paying manufacturing jobs across America's industrial heartland in recent decades, Sanders' long history of opposition to free trade deals, such as the North American Free Trade Agreement, resonated with many Democratic voters. Although Clinton recently came out in opposition to the proposed 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, or TPP, currently before Congress, the former Secretary of State had supported the deal in remarks made in 2012, where she said the TPP sets the gold standard in trade agreements. In contrast, Bernie Sanders has consistently expressed the view that American workers should not be forced to compete against people in low-wage countries such as China, Vietnam, and Mexico. While the Democratic Party has long been divided on free trade issues, the majority of Republican politicians have reliably supported free trade deals. That's why President Obama, who is pushing for passage of the TPP agreement, is depending on GOP votes to win the day. Donald Trump's opposition to free trade is another reason the billionaire real estate developer has attracted new voters to his campaign, defying Republican orthodoxy and angering the party's establishment. Your reporter spoke with Melinda St. Louis, International Campaigns Director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who examines the growing public opposition to free trade deals, which is now challenging the long-standing bipartisan elite consensus in support of free trade.
NAFTA, which was signed and came into force in 1994, we now have more than 20 years of experience of this experiment, which was to create a trade agreement, so-called trade agreement, but to stuff it full of all these basically incentives for offshoring of U.S. jobs in the name of free trade. And what has happened is really a decimation of the U.S. manufacturing base. In the era of NAFTA and other free trade agreements, one in four manufacturing jobs in the United States has been offshored. And that's 5 million jobs. That doesn't only affect the people who specifically lost their job when their plant closed and it shipped off to Mexico or even to China, but it's actually created a downward pressure on all wages because it's undermined the ability of organized labor to bargain collectively when there's a threat that a factory will leave. The service sector jobs that many people had to take after they lost these good manufacturing jobs, higher paying manufacturing jobs, took pay cuts without benefits. And, you know, I think people in the heartland and all over really are feeling how what economists now agree that our U.S. trade policy has been a major contributing factor to the rise in income inequality in the United States. And while elites continue to push, and on both parties, you know, elites in both parties have pushed this model of corporate-dominated trade rules branded as free trade, the people, you know, have been really hurt and have a strong sense that this is wrong-headed and that we need a change in this policy that has been basically part and parcel of the elite consensus pushing through these trade agreements negotiated in secret, behind closed doors, without public participation, and with you know, undue influence of corporations that then are the ones, the elite benefit while people are losing their jobs and they're losing buying power, et cetera. And, you know, people are hurting. And I think that's what we're seeing now in the context of the election.
In speaking about free trade, as you've mentioned, there's an elite consensus in Washington, D.C. that supports free trade. And you've got politicians of both parties supporting these free trade deals. What could you say about that elite consensus and who are the primary beneficiaries of free trade when it comes to politicians, but maybe more importantly, the corporate elite that sponsor these politicians?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's one more example of, unfortunately, the state of our, you know, of our democratic system, where there is so much corporate money is flowing into Washington. So it's the big pharmaceutical companies, it's the Wall Street firms that were able to sneak in rules in the TPP that undermine our ability to re-regulate after the crisis. And you see the drug companies expanding their monopolies, obviously the opposite of free trade. You see Hollywood trying to limit internet freedom in the name of copyright. And you see tobacco companies trying to increase their tobacco trade, et cetera. And so those are the beneficiaries of this elite consensus, unfortunately, at the expense of the rest of us.
We see the success of Bernie Sanders against Hillary Clinton and his staunch opposition of free trade deals. We also see the kind of ugly populism on the part of Donald Trump and his opposition to free trade, despite the fact that the Republican Party has long stood in support of free trade. Are you optimistic that we will soon see a crumbling of the elite consensus that supports free trade deals?
Well, I certainly hope so. And I think there are signs that it's happening. I mean, I think that there is an unprecedented coalition and campaign that is opposing the TPP. I mean, we've been doing this work for years, and we haven't seen this level of unity in terms of every trade union, the environmental organizations, consumer groups, faith groups, women's groups, LGBT groups, senior organizations that are really paying attention to this and are saying no. So I think that that's quite hopeful, you know, and I think that it's some of the commentary that we've been seeing in the last few days. I think some of the economists are getting really worried that this elite consensus, there are some cracks there. In some ways, I think the level of opposition to this by some of the top candidates before, I think there was lip service paid because, again, they look at the polling and they know people don't like this. But I think we actually have candidates now who are serious about not supporting this. And the fact that that is resonating so much with the electorate, I think, you know, is a good sign. I think it's going to take a lot of work because there's a lot of money, as I mentioned, behind pushing this agenda. And so we can't let up as movements to make sure that we're educating people about this and holding our members of Congress feet to the fire and really demanding that they stand with their constituents on this.
That was Melinda St. Louis, International Campaigns Director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. For more analysis and commentary on growing public opposition to free trade policies, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For decades, many conservatives in the U.S. have asserted that we can either have jobs or save the environment, but not both. But the green economy is gaining a foothold, mostly through the development of solar and wind energy production, as well as through the promotion of energy efficiency, which creates lots of jobs. Today, the old economic argument that it's jobs versus the environment seems even more ridiculous, as more and more jobs are being lost in the fossil fuel sector. The last year, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reported on the number of green jobs in the United States. They found that 3.1 million people were employed in green jobs in 2010, representing 2.4% of all jobs nationwide that year. By many accounts, that number increases substantially every year. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Robert Poland, Distinguished Professor of Economics and Co-Director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He spent much of his career studying green jobs, and in 2014 was the primary author of a study commissioned by the Center for American Progress titled Green Growth, a U.S. Program for controlling climate change and expanding job opportunities. Poland's research broke down many aspects of job creation in both the old and new energy economies, and concluded that the green economy produces 3 times as many jobs than the fossil fuel energy economy does. Here, Professor Polan talks about his study and the urgency of addressing climate change.
The Center for American Progress study really tries to do two big, big things, which is, first of all, to develop a program to drive emissions, CO2 emissions in the United States down by 40% as of 2030. And I try to show how this can be done realistically, number one. And then number two, that the project of accomplishing that is not going to be a burden on economic growth or job opportunities. To the contrary, it's a positive source of job opportunities through investments in energy efficiency and renewable energy, which in my view are the two key features of any green economy program.
You know, people on the right have been saying for decades that it's jobs versus the environment, which seems ridiculous. Do you think they say that just because they're in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry?
Well, some of them are. But even if they are, you know, I've debated people like this, and I don't really care if they're in the pocket. They still have to produce research, and if maybe their research is right. But the point is that there's no question that jobs are going to be lost in the fossil fuel sector. That's a given if we're going to transition out of fossil fuels and into clean energy. Actually, something I'm working on right now is developing what we can call a just transition program for people who and communities who will be affected. So that's one thing. And that is a big driver. So you have people, politicians in coal country and so forth, who are jumping up and down, and I understand their concern. It's real. But the broader question is, when we do a transition out of fossil fuels and into the green economy, considering the economy as a whole, you will get many more jobs. My rough estimate is about 3 times more jobs per dollar of expenditure by building and maintaining a green energy economy as opposed to maintaining the fossil fuel economy. We know that building the green economy, and by green economy I'm really talking about 2 things. Renewables is one, and the other is efficiency. Of the two, to me, the single most important is efficiency. Anyway, building the green economy is good for jobs.
Bob Polan, for decades, peace people have been saying that if you put $1 million into military spending, it creates X number of jobs. But if you spend the same amount on teachers or healthcare workers, it creates more jobs. But how much is that a function of military-related jobs, or in this case, fossil fuel-related jobs, just being better-paying jobs?
It's about 20% of the answer with the green economy. The average job in what we will call the fossil fuel economy is going to pay about 20% more than the average job in the green sectors. But keep in mind, I'm saying there's 300% more jobs. So when you break that down in terms of numbers of jobs, that still means there's more good-paying jobs in the green sector. It's just that they're a lower percentage. So there's more good-paying jobs in the green sector, there's more medium-paying jobs, and there's more bad jobs, because there's 3 times more jobs. There's more of everything.
But how did you come up with the 3 times more number?
The U.S. government does surveys of business enterprises or entities, public-private operations, and in the surveys, they basically ask the business, you know, what do you do when you turn on the lights? How do you produce the things you produce? How do you combine workers? What do you pay the workers? And how much are you using in terms of equipment, machinery, buildings, land, and so forth? Okay, so that's the raw material that I'm working with. And then the government organizes that material into this extremely useful set of data, which is called the input-output model. So inputs are basically referring to all the things that people do every day to produce things. And then the outputs are the things they produce. When you use that table as a research tool, you are able to get these ratios The way I personally got into the research was exactly to address the question that you posed at the beginning, which is jobs versus the environment. Do we really have to think of it as that way? That, of course, everyone is concerned about, you know, protecting the environment. And in particular, we obviously have to care a whole lot about stabilizing the climate. So the question is, does that have to be done through sacrificing job opportunities? That really was my research question. And after many years of working on it, my answer is no.
That was Robert Polin, professor of economics and co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Find links to Polin's study on green jobs and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Millions of Japanese citizens observed a moment of silence as their nation marked the fifth anniversary of the devastation wrought by the 9.0 magnitude earthquake and tsunami that struck on March 11, 2011. The monster quake, centered off Japan's northeast coast, killed more than 19,000 and left some 2,500 missing and unaccounted for. The most serious damage resulting from the earthquake occurred at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power complex, where three nuclear reactors lost their coolant and melted down. The disaster, the worst nuclear accident in the world since Chernobyl, caused hydrogen explosions in containment buildings and the release of massive amounts of radioactive material into the atmosphere, groundwater, and the Pacific Ocean. The plant's operator, TEPCO, estimates that it will take 30 to 40 years to safely decommission the now dangerously radioactive reactors. The nuclear plant is still releasing thousands of tons of radioactive water, and over 1,000 tanks filled with contaminated water surround the destroyed reactors. The Japanese government has opened two of the nation's other nuclear plants that were shut down after the earthquake, and plans to reactivate more of the nation's 42 commercial reactors in the months ahead. Your reporter spoke with Tim Judson, executive director with the group Nuclear Information and Resource Service, who assesses the status of the Fukushima nuclear disaster and cleanup operation, as well as the post-Fukushima condition of the nuclear power industry around the world.
About 160,000 people were evacuated from the area of Fukushima, which is a fairly rural area for Japan. But there were also mistakes in the course of the evacuation, where because the utility company that operated the plant was providing incomplete information about the direction in which the radiation plume was being blown, there were people that became exposed to high levels of radiation along the roads because they were directed to evacuate using the wrong routes. So those people have suffered very high levels of exposure to radiation. You know, I think there's an idea that, you know, that the accident happened, you know, during March and April of 2011. The reality is that this accident is not under control. They have not been able to even identify where the melted nuclear fuel is in the plants because the radiation levels inside are too high. And, you know, and for the last 5 years, there's been, you know, because this is a coastal nuclear plant, you know, next to mountains, there's a lot of rain and groundwater. There's been 300 tons of radioactively contaminated water washing through the site and out into the ocean for the last 5 years. And the government and TEPCO have not been able to stop that constant leaching of radioactivity into the ocean for this entire time. So you have, you know, essentially the whole sort of coastal area off of Fukushima is awash in radioactive contamination. The fishing industry around there has been decimated by this. You know, it's just not legal or safe to fish and to sell fish for consumption. There is some notion that actually Japan got lucky to some extent because for most of the first few days in which the meltdowns were occurring, the wind was actually blowing from Fukushima out to the sea. And so a lot of the radiation that was released from the meltdowns actually was pushed out over the water. And only for a couple of days during that time was the wind blowing towards communities that were on the land. And that essentially saved the capital city of Tokyo of 20 million people from having to be evacuated. If the wind had been blowing in another direction, the former prime minister, Shinzo Abe, has said that the capital city might have needed to be evacuated, and there could have been many, many, many more deaths in the short term from radiation exposure than there were. So, you know, in addition to the fact that, you know, that there's clear public health issues, that, you know, there's been a significant uptick in the amount of thyroid disease among children who were, you know, exposed to the radiation plumes and living in the area. You also have, you know, the immense amount of social stress that comes from the dislocation that that all of these hundreds of thousands of people are experiencing.
I have read that in the past few months, the number of nuclear reactors under construction across the world has hit a 25-year high, with around 60 to 70 reactors now being built. And this, of course, in spite of Fukushima and the justified concern that citizens all around the world have about the safety of nuclear power. Please comment, if you would.
Sure. Well, I think that the notion that nuclear construction is increasing is, I mean, it's a complicated one. I mean, there's only really nuclear plants being built in, you know, in a very small handful of countries, and that includes China and South Korea, somewhat in India. But there, I think what you're probably seeing, in, you know, is as far as an increase in construction, is that actually the construction of nuclear power plants is constantly behind schedule. They're constantly not meeting deadlines. And so you're noticing essentially sort of a backlog of reactors that should have been completed by now being met with reactors that are starting to be built. And, you know, that might look like there's more reactors under construction. Well, what we really expect to see is that this industry globally is fading. We've got reactors that are closing in the U.S. Germany is planning to phase out nuclear power. Even France, which is the most nuclear country in the world, is planning on reducing its reliance on nuclear power pretty extensively in the next 10 years. This industry is really at a plateau or declining, and I think more likely the latter.
That was Tim Judson, executive director with the group Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Learn more about the ongoing disaster at Fukushima and the effects of radiation on human health by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.